Can we reform capitalism to save the climate? Ian Angus doesn't think so. Angus believes, quote, ecological destruction is not an accidental feature of capitalism. It is built into the system's DNA. Ian Angus spoke on climate and capitalism at Langara College, Vancouver, on November 15th, 2007.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming. Like Dion and the Liberals before them, like Bush in the U.S., Harper and the Conservatives don't actually want to do very much about climate change. They have been spending an awful lot of time, and the corporations that fund them have been spending a lot of time, trying to avoid doing anything about climate change. And they have been doing that extremely well. Until this year, the corporate strategy for avoiding action on climate change has mostly been in stage one, denial. This stage has involved two main tactics. Number one is arguing that there is enormous uncertainty about climate change. In fact, arguing that there's a big question about whether there's any problem at all. And at the same time, trying to convince the victims of global warming, that is us, that it's really our fault if it does exist. We did it. The uncertainty card has been played very, very effectively. So let me just be really clear on this. There is no doubt whatsoever that global warming is occurring at an unprecedented rate, and that it is caused by human activity, and that if we don't stop it by the end of this century, the planet will be hotter than it has ever been since humans walked the Earth. Only a few cranks disagree with that. But that has not stopped corporate and political leaders from claiming that they don't have enough information to decide if the problem even exists, let alone what might have to be done about it. In fact, virtually any article you read about global warming includes a quote from so-called experts who deny that global warming exists. They seem to represent a vast network of climate change deniers. The Financial Post has been running a series that's up to about number 40 of profiles of various deniers. Maybe it's well past 40 by now. But there certainly seem to be an awful lot of them. Well, in January of this year, the Union of Concerned Scientists published a study that demonstrated something quite intriguing. And that is this very vocal network of global warming deniers was in fact comprised of an extremely small group of people who work through something like 30 different front groups. They are paid to make global warming look uncertain. The report showed that the main funding for these groups comes from ExxonMobil, which is, by the way, the world's largest publicly traded company. And as I say, it paid them to manufacture uncertainty. The report described this as the most sophisticated and most successful disinformation campaign since the tobacco industry tried to convince the world that tobacco doesn't cause cancer. And in fact, by the way, there are documents that show that they literally studied how the tobacco industry did it and set out to create exactly the same tactics. ExxonMobil, by no coincidence whatsoever, is the world's single largest corporate producer of greenhouse gases. If ExxonMobil was a country, it would be the sixth largest source of carbon dioxide and related emissions in the entire world. So while ExxonMobil was doing the job of funding the people who were trying to produce doubt, other corporate and government agencies were working hard to divert attention from the large-scale pollution that's caused by the fossil fuel industry. These groups have focused on blaming the victims for not cutting back, for not insulating our walls, for not using low-power light bulbs. Some of you may remember the Rick Mercer one-ton challenge commercials, in which he repeatedly went on the air and said, if all of us just reduced our own personal emissions by one ton, the world would be a much better place. Well, it probably would be, but in fact, it wouldn't make much of a dent in the problem of global warming. Yes, indeed, people, the message of all of this was, global warming is your fault. You did it. Clean up your act. Now, I am not criticizing conservation. It's important we should do what we can. But as long as the fossil fuel giants continue business as usual, such individual efforts are going to have very little effect. But the denial strategy, which has been in effect for some years now, has just about reached the end of its rope. First, the scientific evidence for global warming gets more powerful every day. The IPCC reports, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports that were issued this year, represent a conservative consensus of the overwhelming majority of scientists, and very few serious objections have been made to those reports. More generally, despite the confusion and misinformation that has been spread by the denial industry, public concern about climate change has actually grown remarkably over the past year or two. Voters and customers want action. So what we're seeing now is that George Bush and Stephen Harper and even ExxonMobil have moved into the second stage of avoiding action on climate change. The second stage involves demonstratively jumping on the green bandwagon and trying to take it over. Stage two is acceptance has three components: greenwash, talk, and solutions that do nothing. Greenwash isn't new. We've been seeing it from many of the world's biggest polluters for years. Even ExxonMobil is joining in the game right now. It recently announced that it has stopped funding all those groups that the Union of Concerned Scientists identified as front groups, which is probably true that they have stopped, because there's not a lot of point in having front groups if everybody knows they're front groups. And they have announced meetings with environmental groups to discuss what legislators might do and so on. The British environmental writer George Monbiot recently had this to say about these image-making efforts of the oil industry. By repositioning themselves in this way as environmentally responsible, they have created the impression that a large and growing oil industry is compatible with runaway climate change. The adverts, in other words, all appear to be examples of greenwash, companies attempting to distract attention from the environmental impacts of their activities. Speaking about the Alberta tar sands, Stephen Dion said, "There is no minister of the environment on earth who can stop this from going forward because there is too much money in it." Tar sands oil, mostly produced in Alberta, is the world's most harmful type of oil for the atmosphere. Getting oil out of the tar sands generates 2.5 to 3 times as much greenhouse gases as conventional oil production. So I'm not talking about what the oil itself produces. I'm talking about the simple effort of getting it out of the ground generates 2.5 to 3 times as much greenhouse gases as traditional oil. The Alberta tar sands are the single largest reason why Canada's greenhouse gas emissions have risen drastically since this country signed the Kyoto Accord. But there's too much money in it, so Dion let it go ahead. So much for the single most important environmental issue facing the world today. Then, having gone through interesting speeches and greenwash, the next stage for the politicians and their corporate friends is to turn to solutions that don't solve anything. Last year, our leading economist Nicholas Stern was reported to the British government on climate change, and his report identified, I think quite accurately ultimately, the source of the problem. He said, "Greenhouse gas emissions are an externality. In other words, our emissions affect the lives of others. When people do not pay for the consequences of their actions, we have a market failure. This is the greatest market failure the world has seen." Externality is a term that capitalist economists use to describe what happens when capitalist corporations don't pay for the damage they cause. Pollution is the perfect example. Individual corporations pollute, but society as a whole bears the cost. The so-called free market, which is supposedly the source of all our wealth and comfort, never deals effectively with externalities. The invisible hand doesn't work. So what should we do about that? Well, some naive, innocent people might conclude that if it's the market that's screwing up, we should stop relying on the market. But no. Nicholas Stern and most government policymakers, on the contrary, say that since markets have failed, let's create more markets. This takes various solutions, but almost all of them involve putting a monetary value on the right to pollute. So if a corporation decides to cut emissions, if it decides it's too expensive to cut emissions, It can buy pollution credits from some other company or for the government, or it can fund green projects in the third world. And all that is, by the way, written into the Kyoto Accord. That's its principal proposal for how to deal with the problem, is to allow people to buy their way out of polluting. George Monbiot has compared this to the medieval practices of selling indulgences, quite apart from the just bizarre idea that the air we have to breathe should somehow be available for sale to the highest bidder. Let's take the simple fact that it's virtually impossible to measure the results of what's called carbon trading. It's subject to massive fraud, and that's been thoroughly exposed in many cases. There's a report published early this year by the Dag Hammarskjöld Institute that proves not only that emissions trading doesn't work, that is, there is zero evidence after all the experiments with emissions trading that's been done in Europe that it's produced any results whatsoever, but it actually makes things worse because it delays actions. So that's one concept, one approach to coping with greenhouse gases by doing something that doesn't in fact change anything. But you know, here in Canada, the Harper government, and by the way in the US, the Bush government, thought even that was too much like actually doing something. So they proposed an approach that was originally dreamed up by the first Bush government, and which has been in liberal programs and conservative programs ever since. Instead of demanding that the polluters reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, they propose that we should use carbon more efficiently. Instead of mandatory emission reductions, they want a voluntary plan. And it won't deal with actual emissions, it will deal with emissions intensity, which means reducing the amount of greenhouse gas that's produced for each unit of production. So the amount of greenhouse gas that an industry would generate, say, per gallon of oil or per car produced or whatever, would be reduced. We'd be more efficient. Now, that sounds good. But if production rises faster than emission intensity goes down, the total emissions actually rise under that scenario. And that is not some hypothetical case. Between 1990 and 2004, Canada's emissions intensity improved 14%, but our total emissions rose 27%. Got more efficient, but produced substantially more as a result. Under the proposal that has come out of the federal government this year, the tar sands projects in Alberta would meet their targets for emissions intensity while still increasing their total emissions by 300%. Emissions intensity basically is a method of setting up targets that corporations will meet anyway, because corporations are constantly trying to reduce their costs and improve their efficiency. But they do it in order to increase market share, which means they do it in order to increase their production. And as these numbers show, and by the way, that's pretty much the way it's worked globally, intensity has improved, but emissions have increased much more. Now, this has to seem a little odd. If you're a reasonable human being, you have to start asking, why do corporations and governments work so hard to stop doing anything or to avoid doing anything about climate change? The Earth is heating up. Our climate is going crazy. Everybody on Earth is going to be affected, and that everybody includes capitalists. It includes the corporations. It includes the politicians. We'll all be affected. Many corporations will be totally destroyed by climate change. Nicholas Stern's estimate, and it's generally viewed he was optimistic, Nicholas Stern estimated that if we don't act, the world's economy will shrink by 20% in this century. And that's a huge reduction. So why don't the people in power do something? The answer, unfortunately, is that the problem isn't rooted in the goodwill or bad will of individuals. It's rooted in the very nature of capitalist society, which is made up of thousands of corporations, all competing for investments and growth and profit. Capital, by its very nature, by its DNA, has to grow. There's no point in investing capital in an enterprise unless I expect to get back more than I put in, unless my capital grows. If I own a big company and I decide that I'm going to invest heavily in cutting greenhouse gas emissions, my profits are going to go down, investors will go elsewhere, they'll take their money out of my company and put it into companies that have higher profits that aren't wasting their money, in capitalist terms, on unproductive investment. Eventually, I'll go out of business. The law of capitalism is grow or die. Anarchic, unplanned growth is not an accident. It isn't a market failure. It's the nature of the beast. Joel Koval writes in the current issue of Canadian Dimension magazine, "Capitalism as such cannot accept limits on its growth any more than a person can cease to breathe. It's fundamental to the system. And because it has to grow, it has to use more raw materials, it has to use more resources, it has to use more energy, it has to generate more greenhouse gases." We're constantly bombarded by propaganda arguing that growth is good. Good pretty much by definition. The main argument that Harper and Bush and Stelmach and others make against cutting greenhouse gas emissions is that will interfere with growth. And all you have to do if you're a politician is stand up and say, "I won't do anything to stop economic growth," and it's instantly that is a good thing. Quote. But what is the measure of growth that we're talking about here? Are we talking about people being better off, better educated, healthier? No. The measure of growth is how much gets sold every day, every week, every year. That includes thousands upon thousands of products that are directly harmful to humans and to nature. It includes commodities that cannot be produced without spreading disease, destroying the forests, poisoning our water, poisoning our air. Doesn't matter. It's growth. That's the way the system measures growth. Growth is so important to capitalism that the system sustains a multi-billion dollar industry whose only role is to manipulate human psychology to create wants, not needs, so that the ever-growing pile of commodities will in fact be purchased. In 2005, the total U.S. spending on advertising was $143 billion. By way of comparison, the Stern Report on Global Warming estimated that the total cost of dealing effectively with global warming, total, not yearly, total cost, would be about $617 billion. So we could cut emissions and adapt to avoid unavoidable changes for less than the USA alone spends on advertising in 5 years. Let me add the obvious statement, by the way, that U.S. military spending is something over $626 billion a year. So that could solve the problem all by itself. But making bombs and tanks and fighter planes and commercials contributes to growth. Ending global warming doesn't. So the money doesn't get spent there. This profound commitment to growth at all costs means that waste and pollution are not accidental side effects of the system we live in. Calling global warming the result of market failure misses the fact that it is a direct and inevitable result of capitalist growth. That's obvious in the numbers. A study by the World Resources Institute found that between one-half and three-quarters of the resource inputs used by industrial economies are returned to the environment as waste within 12 months. Within 12 months of our economy using natural resource inputs, those half to three-quarters of them are returned as pollution, as landfill, as global warming gas. That's what capitalism does with natural resources. It trashes them. It turns them into landfill and pollution and greenhouse gases. As John Bellamy Foster writes, the market system cannot possibly absorb or pay for the damage it costs. So those costs are either unpaid or offloaded onto society as a whole. The ecological economist William Capp put it much more simply. He said, capitalism must be regarded as an economy of unpaid costs. And when you talk about that volume of environmental destruction created by every input, none of that cost paid, none of that destruction of our environment, you see why Capp said it was unpaid costs. We live in an economy that is based on the earth, the historical wealth of this earth going unpaid and subsidizing the profits of corporations. That's why capitalism cannot solve global warming. The solutions are going to involve major shifts in production and consumption patterns, in particular reducing our use of energy. It's going to involve massive spending and wrenching economic change. In capitalist terms, that's all going to be non-profitable investment, and that's in an economy that cannot function without profit. The solutions are going to have to be global. Air and water don't stop at human borders. Only an economy that's going to that will require radical reorganization of the economy on a global level and taking global issues into account, not offloading our pollution onto the third world, which is what we've been doing over the past couple of decades, sending our dirtiest industries to China and India and South America. Only an economy that's organized for human needs, not for profit, has any chance of slowing global warming and reversing the damage that's already been done. Only democratic socialist planning can overcome the problems that are caused by capitalist anarchy. Only a system that gives priority to human needs and the restoration of ecosystems can stop and then reverse global warming. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to wait for socialism to do anything. On the contrary, it's critical that we fight for change now. It's very possible to win some important gains, and building the movement for such gains will be an important part of building a movement for socialism. In my view, a radical movement against global warming can be built around these kinds of demands, and I think they will evolve over time, but these are the kinds of things that we should be fighting for in the present framework. The government must establish and enforce rapid, mandatory reductions in CO2 emissions. Real reductions, not phony trading plans or intensity improvements. You know, when you read the books, I'm currently reading a book called Hot Air, which is a very good account of Canadian global warming policy, but they go into how long this is all going to take. There's a whole discussion of how long it takes to restructure and redirect industry. It's going to take decades to do anything. When World War II broke out, and the Canadian government and the leaders of Canada decided that this was a fight worth fighting, they literally sat down with the major corporations, the car manufacturers to start with, and said, you are now going to reorient production to produce tanks and ships and all the things we need to win this war. And you know they did it, and they did it in months. They completely redirected our economy. The car industry in Canada stopped making cars for the duration. You can have whatever attitude or evaluation you would like of World War II. My point is that if you want to make these changes, if you're serious about making them, you can do it. But it requires a willingness to take on profit as a motivator. We have to insist that the companies that produce greenhouse gases pay the full cost of cutting the emissions. We have to stop subsidies to oil, gas, and coal. You know, one of the things about the greenhouse, about the Alberta tar sands, one of the reasons they have grown so fast is, and have generated so much greenhouse gas in the process, is that they are extensively subsidized by the federal and provincial governments that are involved through tax breaks of all kinds, and by paying far less than the cost of getting of the raw materials they're using. And we need to redirect the billions that are now being spent on wars and debt payments into public transit, into retrofitting buildings for energy efficiency, and into renewable energy projects. At the same time, the movement against climate change has to win the support of the labor movement and give support to third world victims of global warming. Corporations and conservative union leaders play on the fear of job losses to convince industrial workers to oppose the environmental movement. We see this constantly. And sadly, on the side of the green movement, we frequently see a kind of equal view of things. I hear people call for shutting down the tar sands. I rarely hear anybody saying, what happens to the thousands of workers and who are employed in the tar sands, what happens to the people whose jobs depend on those people, and so on. Those people are not responsible for global warming, and they shouldn't have to pay the price. So part of the demand for restructuring industry has to be coupled with opposition to layoffs, to full access to retraining and relocation at the corporation's expense, at full union pay. And we need to support the third world in its struggle against domination and distortion of their economies. There's been a lot of material in the paper this year about how China has had an extraordinary increase in the amount of greenhouse gases that it produces. And that's true, although on a per capita basis, China remains very, very far behind what happens routinely in Canada, the United States, and Europe. One of the reasons it has such large emission levels is simply its huge population. But there's another huge factor in China, and that is that corporations in North America and Europe have been actively exporting their dirtiest production to China. This huge economic growth that we hear about in China, something, there was a report came out a couple of weeks ago, between 25 and 30% of all Chinese production is exported to Europe and North America. So whose greenhouse gases are there, was the question. Are those, was asked. We need to stop dumping pollution on the third world. We need to export clean technologies. We need to help the third world focus on agriculture for use, not for export and profit, because one of the worst things that's been happening, a huge greenhouse gas generator, and it's done in the name of cleaning things up, is the shift to biofuel, where we see in Europe, European governments saying we want to stop using petroleum, so we want to shift over to fuels made from plants, and they're giving subsidies to companies that do that. So what those companies are doing is moving into countries like Indonesia and Uganda, Paraguay, driving peasants off the land, cutting down huge forests and planting huge amounts of monocultures, soy in Paraguay, palm trees in Indonesia, onto farms whose size utterly beggars the imagination. And I'm talking literally about hundreds of square miles and single production units. They produce enormous amounts of greenhouse gases, and they, of course, take food and water away from the people who live in those areas. To stop doing that. The example of Cuba, which is a very poor country with very limited resources, shows what can be done. The World Wildlife Fund recently reviewed a whole set of countries, and they identified Cuba as the only country in the world that meets the requirements of sustainable development. Now, Cuba is a poor country, and nobody would say that's the way we should live or the way the world should live. But nevertheless, what it shows is development is possible without producing massive greenhouse gases, because this happened. Cuba has a sustainable economy that does not pollute the environment at a time when its economy has been growing twice as fast as the Latin American average. In 1918, in the midst of the most horrible war the world had ever seen, the great German socialist leader Rosa Luxemburg wrote that the choice facing the world at that time was socialism or barbarism. And as we know, socialism did not triumph in the 20th century. Instead, what we had was a century of wars and genocide. The very barbarism that Rosa Luxemburg had warned was inevitable if the capitalist system remained in place. Today we face that choice in a new and potentially even more destructive form. Echoing Marx and Engels and echoing Rosa Luxemburg, we can say that humanity's choice in the 21st century is eco-socialism or barbarism. There is no third way. Thank you.
That was Climate and Capitalism by Ian Angus. This speech was recorded on November 15, 2007 at Langara College, Vancouver, by Radio EcoShock. Find out more about Ian Angus and the alternatives to capitalism at his blog, Climate and Capitalism. That's www.climateandcapitalism.blogspot.com.